You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Santa Fe Institute's Community Lecture Series brings leading thinkers to Santa Fe to explore profound questions. Why do some societies enforce monogamous marriage while the majority allow polygyny? How does inheritance vary from one society to the next? Tuesday, April 16th at 7:30 p.m., anthropologist Laura Fortunato will discuss how human social behavior evolves. Reserve your free seat at ticketssantafe.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks Lana Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. David Osher. He's Vice President and Institute Fellow at the American Institutes for Research in the Washington, D.C. area and beyond. And he is visiting New Mexico to talk about education. This is part of our education series. Tell us a little bit about your own story. You came from a working class family in New York City. You ended up in an elite university. How did you decide to make education your life's work?
Thank you for having me. I think that's a real good question. When I was in graduate school, I assumed that I would be a professor. And when I left graduate school, initially I assumed that I would be focused on just teaching at a college and university level. The path that led me to education was in the late 70s, I had the privilege with other people of helping develop a professional school of human services that was aimed at working with people who had gotten into the human services as paraprofessionals or as consumers of human services or as organizers, most of whom had not had great experiences in schools. However, things really changed dramatically when my wife and I adopted two children, who were our second and third children, our first child we had biologically, and both of them had experienced 5 years of abuse and neglect, both in families and in dysfunctional social service systems. When they came to us, the issues of their learning, as well as the other supports that they needed, were very, very palpable. And over time, my wife and I decided that what we would want to do with our lives, and we decided both individually, but it was in sync with each other, is to do things to try to make things work better and more directly for children like our children. My intellectual interest was on what sociologists call school effects. And that is that I am interested in, and I think there is compelling research to show that schools are never neutral. They can amplify problems, or they can attenuate those problems. They can contribute to people thriving, or they can be risk factors that place kids and young adults at greater risk of trouble.
You're visiting New Mexico, which in so many ways is a microcosm of the country in terms of the problems we face. And I sort of hate to go through this litany because it's a way that we kind of feel bad about ourselves because, I mean, there's a lot of good in New Mexico, but we do have poverty, addiction, cultural loss, things like that. And I think there's a sense of despondency or kind of resignation when we come in 49th or 50th in childhood well-being and early childhood education, things like that. How can a state like ours start thinking about having a more successful education system, including a definition of success that goes beyond test scores?
I would start by the fact that ranking systems are both useful in terms of gaining attention, but that in reality what is happening in New Mexico is also happening to a good extent across the country. Most young people are not doing well or as well as they could be. There are particularly pronounced disparities for kids of color and, you know, kids from communities that experience marginalization. And so it's not that New Mexico is not unique. New Mexico is unique. The fact that it is on the border with Mexico makes it unique. The fact that at one point in time, a majority of the people in New Mexico spoke Spanish, and probably at some point Spanish or a number of First Nation languages and not English makes it a particularly different place. But at the same time, I really think there are general things. Now, in terms of the issues, I actually think that if one looks at negative data as a friend and does not run away from the negative data, but says, okay, this starts telling me what I have to do, then one can start. And one doesn't have to start by wallowing in the negative data. I think people, everybody, families also have assets, and it's important to figure out what those assets are because of the fact that those assets give you toeholds that help you move towards change. And I think, and I knew this before I came to New Mexico because I have colleagues who are in New Mexico. I certainly have a sense of this from having met with the Joint Legislative Committee that focuses on education, as well as people that were brought together by the Thornburg Foundation. But I think that those are examples of assets. I mean, I think the great cultural wealth that exists in a whole variety of different ethnic communities, I think, and tribal communities, are resources that can be tapped. So that's a piece. I think if the particular focus, as I think it is at this moment in time, this is actually a particularly important moment of time. On the one hand, the issues that make it hard, including people experiencing adversities, are not going away. We know that the economy in terms of, and I'm thinking national figures, I'm not looking at figures in terms of New Mexico, but the stresses on working class and poorer people are great. The issues of culture and people feeling whether or not their culture is respected or not are pronounced. And so I think issues are very, very salient. And at the same time, there is an accumulation of knowledge and experience. Knowledge coming from the scientific community, experience coming from practice wisdom, which is both based on doing some things that work and also learning from what doesn't work. So for example, we had this great national experiment for 10 years called No Child Left Behind, I'm not being specific. And if you wanted to test out whether or not just doubling down and tripling down on test performance and ignoring the rest of children and ignoring the needs of teachers would get you somewhere, I think we have a very salient lesson. So practice lessons.
It didn't work.
Yes, it did not work. I mean, it's very interesting because the one thing that it did work was to collect the data to show that it didn't work. And I think that's paradoxical, but very, very important.
Right.
But we have that knowledge. And so it would not be sensible if one's trying to build a system based on what we know doesn't work. At the same time, there is a powerful accumulation of research, and more than accumulation, convergence across many sciences and many disciplines. Science is like the science of learning. Science is like studying resilience. Disciplines like sociology and education and psychology and developmental psychology that converge in really suggesting to us that if we are able in a strategic way of addressing the whole child, and that includes the whole child in terms of her or his relational ecological environment, which includes not just the child, but the adults who work with the children, the peers who interact with the children, the families who support the children, that we have an opportunity to really change trajectories for young people in terms of learning, and to change those trajectories in terms of well-being if they have experienced adversities because of the fact that there is a great deal of neuroplasticity and wonderful windows of opportunities as children develop so that in the right circumstances and at the right level of support, which may be different from every child, one can really do things that would make a dramatic difference. And so there's a need in terms of knowing where you are. There are cultural assets, I think, and people assets that exist in New Mexico. There is a convergence of scientific knowledge. I think practice knowledge is empowered by that convergence because many teachers I know, and looking at teacher surveys and principals and superintendents, always knew that just doubling and tripling down on on test performance alone was not going to necessarily do things. And there's this pressing need, and I think in New Mexico it may actually be fueled by the court case as well, which really talks about the dramatic lack of opportunities to learn for many young people in New Mexico.
Let's talk about that in specifics. I mean, so there's this convergence of different fields that are pointing toward the same kinds of practices. You talk about a place called North Lawndale in the Chicago area, which you've said it might be a little bit like Española, New Mexico in some ways. Talk about this school and its journey.
Sure. And let me be clear here that I use that as an example because last night at dinner I was hearing about Española. And I also wanted to point out that all because children come from a place where there are needs and they are needy themselves does not mean that they cannot realize a great deal. You know, what I've seen both as a researcher but as an observer of many places is you can have two schools next to each other serving kids from the same community and have very, very different outcomes because of what I call school effects. There can be a school that can really be a safe haven, that can be a place of healing as well as a place of academic engagement and of a community where you have low levels of suspension or maybe no suspension. And next door, you can have a school where you have disengaged children, higher levels of absenteeism, and that's not the kids, it's the entire environment.
So what's the difference? What do they do differently from one school to the next?
I think the schools that look at what they can do rather than blame students for what they can't do make a difference. And so it's important that people acknowledge the challenges that children bring in. But if the challenge becomes an explanation for why children do not do as well, there's a problem, and what tends to, it's a systemic problem because you don't change what you're doing. Whereas if you really say, I have to succeed, and what do we do as a community so we can succeed, then you keep on doing things until you do succeed. So I want to give you a metaphor before I go back to the school. You and probably your listener have seen Apollo 13, the movie?
I haven't, but yes.
Oh, okay, so I'll describe there are two incidents in Apollo 13 that are really important. Incident number one is where the person who's the head of flight control comes into a room, dumps all the stuff that is in the vehicle and says, figure out a way of getting people home. You have nothing else you can do. And that's an example of the type of planning that has to happen. You can't wish for the fact that your kids, the students that you have, didn't have trauma. You cannot wish for the fact that your children didn't come in with other things. You figure out what you have, and then you figure out the way that comes home. And then there's another piece later on where they're trying to engineer getting the vehicle home, and the person who's working on the startup of a battery says, I can now get it to start up in 2.5 seconds or something like that. And the person who's looking at it says, that's not good enough. It'll burn up. Places that work with young people successfully have a commitment to their success. Understand the fact that the school can do something. Support staff so staff can feel able to do something. Look at data to help them get better, not to blame students or to run away from things to make themselves look good. And ultimately build conditions for learning and build and equip people with the types of competencies that they need to succeed. Okay, so now let me go to North Lawndale in Chicago. Place that is very different from Española, and I've never been to Española. I was hearing about it last night. But I think just like Española struggles with some issues, like gangs, like violence, like poverty, like trauma, and I bet Española is just like North Lawndale, also has wonderful assets that exist within the community that are leverageable. And the academy was created, actually, I think, by a former priest and who really talked about the school as a moral community. And I heard that from the young people as well when I talked about telling me why you don't fight outside as well. And they said they really answered about being a moral community and what were their responsibilities. But I think that what was very important in terms of that school was focusing both on providing young people with the support they needed to succeed, and at the same time coupling that with wanting them to succeed big time. So that to me, the choice of not spending money on metal detectors and putting the money into academic counselors who would also stay with students for many years and provide them with support, or the message that is given to young people that this is not about graduating from high school, this is about graduating from college, is part of a culture of a place that starts to make a difference. And I think that the principal was able to both select good teachers who could fit there, but also support people. They felt able and they were equipped to be what the young people in North Lawndale said to me is like another set of parents or a right. set of aunties and uncles. And more importantly, they were also culturally competent. That connection between children and teachers was very, very important. And so when you heard me say earlier that students said to me that they could handle challenge because teachers had their back, but let me go further. They described what having my back was. They described about not having transportation to go to a college interview and then the teacher saying, let me take you.
Which sometimes runs into bureaucratic limitations because for liability reasons, yeah. a kid isn't allowed to get yeah. into a teacher's car and yeah. things like that. Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about a family model and you're talking about a kind of public bureaucracy, there's some tensions there.
I think that's right. And I think that part of the issue would have to be, how do you equip with waivers and protections for people to be able to do things? And at the same time, do it in a way that knows that the issue of adults, even well-selected adults abusing children, is not an impossibility. But I think you can be successful, not when you ignore a problem, not when you say, oh, our teachers are different, they're going to, everything's fine, but where you build in checks to make sure that it doesn't happen.
When you talk about teachers becoming kind of almost like aunts and uncles or another set of parents, you're talking about really engaging the kids on many levels, not just academic, yeah. but also emotional. And there's a lot that's been written about social and emotional learning. What is that, and how does it relate to academics?
Social emotional learning is how we develop the cognitive, social, and emotional skills and attitudes that can help us succeed in life. And that can happen outside of school. Social emotional learning does not just start when you're in school. Years ago, we used to think that there was this set personality characteristics that people had. And, you know, he's just restless. He's always going to be that way. Boys will be boys. I think we now know that we actually can, in an intentional way, help young people and adults develop their emotional intelligence, develop their social intelligence. That can be done through programs that can be implemented well in schools. It can be done by integrating social-emotional learning practices in schools. It can be done by equipping young people in different ways so that they can self-monitor themselves. But one way or the other, it helps students develop the ability to understand and manage emotions, understand and manage their relationships, and to be able to be reflective and mindful when they need to be. And remember, this is for kids who are going through lots of things, so it's not perfect, but it is equipping people with a set of skills.
So let's talk about it in a really specific way. I mean, let's say we're in a classroom. You are trained in not only English teaching, but social-emotional learning. You're the teacher. I'm the student. I, last night, witnessed some violence in the home. I'm really freaked out. What now? What do you do? I can't focus. I'm having trouble.
Yeah.
What happens?
I think what you want to do is equip teachers with social emotional knowledge as well as develop their own social emotional competencies so that the teacher would know that if that child is going to learn, the teacher is going to have to respond to that need right now.
So in a sense, the teacher has to be almost like a therapist in terms of having that understanding of what's going on?
I don't think the teacher has to be a therapist. In fact, I would not want the teacher to be a therapist. But I think a teacher can be somebody who can be a mentor, who can be a supporter. And at the same time, you want to equip that teacher with knowledge so that if there is something that that teacher can't do, they can gracefully get someone else to help the child who can.
Right. And teachers don't want to do
that. Right. That's right. But there's a difference between that and doing what is essential to learning. This week is the 50th anniversary of a wonderful program developed by Dr. James Comer called the School Development Program. One of the things that Dr. Comer has said is that relationship between a teacher and a student and students and each other's is to learning like location is to real estate. So you do not have to, as a teacher, be a clinician, but you do have to be a person who can establish a productive and meaningful relationship with a student that will enable you to hear what that student needs, will enable you to provide feedback to that student in a way that the student can hear, will enable you to try to do things that do not contribute for many students to what we call stereotype threat.
What's that?
That's when people feel as a function of prejudices that exist in a society, whether it's people who speak a different language or people whose color is a different hue or whose gender is different, where you feel that you really need to perform better because of that. And stereotype threat just raises levels of stress that people have. And because of that, it compromises performance.
Right. So if I'm a girl and the teacher has just made a sexist comment, and Lord knows this happened to me in high school, yeah, and happened to many girls in high school, to bounce back from that is hard.
Yeah. The language would call that a microaggression. You know, when what happens is that you have been offended, insulted, one way or the other, you have to handle it. And you have to use things that are in your reserve that are therefore not available for something else to handle that. Because all of us have bandwidth issues. There's only so much we can do. Where you might have experienced stereotype, and there may be lots of others, is girls don't do science well, or things like that, where you then feel that you got to really perform if you are interested in science in a way to show, okay, and you're being under a greater level of vigilance. And both of them are hurtful, and both of them put additional stresses on, and they come from a common set of stereotypes, and oftentimes the people who are doing it, even though they are perpetrating an act of hurt, aren't even aware of it. So social emotional learning can help equip you to handle academic challenges, but it's also necessary because of the fact that it can help students perform in groups, and you want that. And for teachers, it can help them, to go back to the case of the young person coming in, be sufficiently aware and attuned so that they can notice the fact that David looks different today.
Or in the example of, let's say you're the teacher, I'm the kid, had something bad happen at home, I'm withdrawn, maybe I'm withdrawn a lot because this thing happens regularly.
Right.
What do you as the teacher do?
If I feel comfortable, what I do in a private moment with a child, so she or he was in no way being embarrassed, I would start with something that really lets the student know how much I care about them and their strengths. So I'm not just saying negatives, but it's more just to do it. But then I'd really try to say, you know, I've seen you do lots of wonderful things, and I'm now watching you and I'm seeing you look so sad, or whatever the characteristics are. And I would probably say, is there any way that I can be of help? What you want to be able to do is frame a discussion in a way that does not risk traumatizing people overly,
right,
but really does let people know that you support them and enable them to meet with somebody else who can even be more supportive.
When I hear you talk, I think, does this require basically a restructuring of the school day? Because if you're in a place where there's a lot of traumatized kids, and a teacher is expected to have a private moment with 5 out of 15 kids or something like that, when do they do that?
I do think we probably need to re-engineer. And I think it's doable. I do not think that this is utopian. When I look at schools and I think about what is necessary to increase performance, the two things that I think are most important are is the amount of time young people are actively engaged in learning.
Meaning?
They're really involved. They're really thinking. They're really processing. They're really learning.
So the way you might be in a heated discussion about a poem,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, or but you're even struggling to solve an equation.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the ability of teachers to be able to differentiate what they do and to personalize it. Now, why am I saying these two things? Because if we look at schools and if we were to clock most kids, most of the time they're not engaged in learning. And so what you want to do is create much more quality intellectual time. And so partially the ability to engage in dialogue and conversation with children and youth, not just about their needs, but about what interests them. If I'm listening to a young person, then I can know more about how I could personalize their learning so that they could be actively engaged. So my answer is, you're right, given the way things are organized, we really don't have a lot of time. However, things are organized with the intellectual quality that is the equivalent of fast food.
The thing you said about high quality and robust intellectual engagement as an absolute necessity to the teaching day, I think is so important. And it reminds me of a story that a friend of mine told me recently where somebody, a teenager in her extended family, had an eating disorder. So they were sending her to a therapist to work on her self-esteem. And she said, well, why don't you send her to me and she can work with me and that will build her self-esteem through actually doing stuff. And the parents didn't want that. But it's made sense to me that by actually doing things that prove her competence, she would gain self-esteem.
That's right. And in this case, what's important is you want people to have self-esteem, but you want it to be based on the accomplishment of pro-social things. I think you're very, very right. And are there a few young people who are at a level of depression that's getting in the way? Probably yes. But even there, the more you provide people with positive, natural, reinforcing opportunities where they can develop competence and succeed, the more they will develop a sense of efficacy, the more they will develop some of that self-esteem, the more you're developing experiential assets that they have in their mind that they can build upon, but you as a teacher or a parent can too as well. You can say, remember when you were doing X? You know, that was really tough, but you were able to ultimately do something.
What happens when you've got kids who are in a school like this, which is doing pretty well in supporting kids emotionally and developing their real, genuine, I mean, hardcore competencies, isn't everybody wonderful and let's give them all a trophy,
right,
kind of thing. And then they go home to the same toxic environment, right, every night.
Ideally, if the environment at home is one that is problematic for the child, what ideally one would like to be able to do is in a way that is culturally responsive and family driven, one can be involved in support of dialogues with families where you help them deal with some of the things they're struggling with. And I'm framing it with all these things because if people just come into families and say, you're not doing good and we can tell you how to do well by your children, that's not going to work. But on the other hand, when you meet with families, and I have, okay, I mean, this is in studying programs that have worked, programs that demonstrate respect for families and listen to the fact that they may have needs to be addressed can help people make environments less toxic and more supportive. At the same time, what happens if you can't do that? I think part of developing young people's social and emotional competence is helping them code switch, is helping them adapt and adopt to different environments. And I think the important thing, though, is to do it in a way that enables young people to understand what they're facing and handle it, but not in a way that is dissing the parent.
So again, let's go to examples. I mean, the most sort of extreme examples we have here in New Mexico, we have many stories of multi-generational opioid addiction.
Yep.
On a less dramatic level, we have the toxicity of the television being on all the time and having that kind of space in which, you know, contemplation and that kind of what you might call creative downtime can't occur.
Right.
And let's say in both cases, neither parent is saying my environment, this environment is toxic for my child and I need help. They're like, we don't want to have anything to do with you. Shut up.
Yeah. I think in those circumstances, it's even more incumbent of the school to figure out how it can successfully use the quality time in the school to offer those points of reflection in those space, and know that at this point, it probably cannot count on the family to do it. Because there aren't good choices. We have demonstrated as a society in our country, but in others as well, that just removing kids from family and putting them into foster care or asylums doesn't work. Okay, so you don't have that solution. And I agree with you that in some cases, it's going to take more time to get families to change. But then what does it mean? What it means is figuring out how they find that safe space, and at the same time, make sure that some of your assignments aren't dependent on that reflective time at home. And so in the case of homework, it would mean making sure that students are either able to do the homework differently and don't need the support of parents to do it.
So here we are in New Mexico, and I was just talking to somebody a little while ago who said that one of their closest friends was a teacher who loves teaching but is really thinking about leaving the profession. And she's got the support of her colleagues and her principal, but it's just burnout work. Yeah. There's so many students. Some of the teachers are paying for things out of their own pockets, which they shouldn't be paying for. Underfunding, I mean, people say, oh, don't throw money at problems, but underfunding is a reality. Yeah. And she's looking at, what am I going to do next? Because I can't keep doing this. So there's lots of good ideas. There's schools, we have these examples of schools that have been turned around and where there's a kind of systemic cultural shift. Where does that have to come from? Does it have to be the principal, the school district? What's the prescription?
Let's start with the problem that you started, which is that we do not treat and honor teachers well in our society, not just New Mexico. And teachers are not paid a lot of money. And the status of being a teacher in our society is not a very, very high one. And there are lots of teachers who end up having to do second jobs, driving Lyft and Uber because of the fact that they can't. And at the same time, schools are not provided with budgets that let them do things. And so teachers, out of the goodness of their commitment, end up doing that. So that's a reality. Now, in most cases, principals or school leaders play a very important role because they can support people, because they can create an emphasis that is pro-student so that they can look at where people need help and then try to find some ways of getting them professional development and support so that they can be experienced by teachers of having their back. And it's having your back with expectation. And I think the expectation for the leader is we have to serve our kids. Our mission is to serve these children well, and we have to do things, but we will work together to do this. We will problem solve to do this. We will try to find the resources to do this. We will develop strategies to do this. And in places that I have seen schools and districts that were addressing zero tolerance behavior preventively. They were doing things so you never had to think about suspending somebody. And we went in with a team of three researchers, an expert panel that included a superintendent and a principal and a family member and a student and things like that to observe. And one of the things that people observed was people were working very hard, but they weren't exhausted. they really felt that they were making a difference. And I think that's what a leader can do. And I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, I was in Guam, and I heard about a school that had been the poorest performing school in Guam that had been turned around by a new principal and an assistant principal. And I went to visit the school. If I can paint a picture for you, it's rainy and it's early in the morning and children are showing up in school and the principal is outside the school with an umbrella. And this was not only the poorest part of Guam, but it was the part of Guam that served young people from the other islands, and so that there was the equivalent of bicultural challenges that existed in the school. I heard all sorts of wonderful things about what they were doing, but I wanted to find someone who had been at the school before they were there who could be a credible witness. So I went to a school counselor who had been there before, and I asked her, is this consistent with what you experienced? And this is what she said to me. Before, as soon as school ended, everyone went home. And now what happens is people hang around. Kids are the same. People's personal lives were the same. But they felt this common mission, and they started to see the children in a different way.
Now, was this the principal who led that?
Yes, it was the principal and the assistant principal. However, I now want to add that I think the best leadership involves the principal, but is what people call distributed. It can't just be the principal. You have to have other people lead as well and lead with you.
If you could wave a magic wand and do a couple of things to change education policy in this country, what would you do?
First of all, I would make sure that we would have metrics to monitor progress that both respond to the variety of individual and contextual factors that are necessary to support learning and well-being. That includes not just looking at what is done, but how it is done. So it's looking at issues of quality. That's the first thing, okay? And it's to have those metrics, and let me add, we would use them transparently. Second thing I would do would be make sure that the processes of monitoring and accountability reinforce people being strategic and addressing the whole child and not just being narrow and addressing the most immediate issue at hand.
Like what?
Well, the example that's often used from, say, No Child Left Behind days is principals who wanted to survive could look at students who were just below proficiency and know that if they could move a certain number of them to the point that they're just above proficiency, you could also look better at the next test. But that's not deeper learning. That's not all kids changing.
It's playing the game.
Exactly. So they'll play the game. And you don't want people playing the game. You want people being strategic. And the third thing would be, I would make sure that not only do we let people know about what practices work and don't work, but we would make sure that we invest resources in helping people implement and realize those practices well. It doesn't have to be that every teacher has to be a rock star and every implementation has to be perfect, but there's a level of quality that is really necessary to make a difference. And it's certainly worth doing because our kids deserve it and it'll make it better in New Mexico.
David Osher is Vice President and Institute Fellow at the American Institutes for Research, which we will link to at radiocafe.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me and thank you very much for a wonderful interview. I like your questions.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.